The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I should say I'm not the person that's going to have translation, as any of you were wondering. What I want to do just to kick this off is to think about the nature of the far right and to distinguish between what you might call the fascist far right and the non-fascist far right. I think this is an issue that's interesting and important for the left because it determines, in a sense, what their tactics are in actually fighting them. So, if you think about the contemporary far right in a British context, for example, then the fascist wing is the British National Party, the English Defence League. The non-fascist far right would be UKIP, who's essentially collapsed following the general election, but nevertheless with a real presence. In America, the American Nazi Party, obviously. On the other hand, the Tea Party as the non-fascist wing. So, some of you, it's quite clear what they are, but I think it's quite important to actually set out what the underlying distinctions are. And I think there are, I'm following here Michael Mann, the sociologist, in some of my own work, but I think there are three key distinctions that you'd want to make in drawing a line between fascist and non-fascist far right. First is that the non-fascist far right tends to be electoral. It doesn't tend to try and establish its position by violence, by controlling the streets, by organising paramilitary gangs and so on, and in a sense seeks to get elected by democratic means, like any other electoral organisation would do. So this is, a fundamental starting point. So like Golden Dawn in Greece is a classic far-right party. It does do some work in distributing food to the people it's trying to influence, but by and large, and it does stand in elections, but by and large it seeks to establish its position by its dominance of the streets, by attacking the far left, by attacking migrants and so on. It clearly functions mainly in a non-democratic kind of way. On the other hand, the Northern League in Italy, clearly it's a very unpleasant party in many ways, and so it does actually function largely as a parliamentary democratic organisation. Now it's not simply about street violence. I think fascist far-right parties are, in a sense, revolutionary. Now, a lot of the left want to refuse the term revolution to anything that doesn't have a socialist revolution, but I think that's wrong. There are political revolutions which do not fundamentally change capitalism. I mean, certainly Hitler's rise to power and indeed Mussolini's were regime-changing revolutions which did not change the nature of capitalism. Those remained capitalist states, but they did overpower the actual state. It imposed a new type of regime that's quite different. In that sense, I think you could call it revolutionary, a revolution of the right in that kind of way. So this is the fundamental distinction about democratic means, about essentially non-democratic means. Now, of course, fascist far-right parties also try to get elected, but they try and take power in the state so they control the state apparatus. This is what Hitler did in Germany. Marine Le Pen and the Front National and so on, and they seek to get elected. They're not building up a paramilitary organisation outside to take power in the state afterwards. And I think we have to be clear about concepts like creeping fascism. Fascism doesn't creep. And a party elected into a parliament wouldn't then just be able to transform a society along fascist lines just because they've got a majority in parliament. The state does actually act to constrain extreme right-wing positions in a similar way to the way it stops left-wing positions. It's usually the left that the state stops, but actually, as Charlie Post pointed out this morning, it can actually act to stop right-wing populist movements as well, as indeed the American state has done with Trump. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that it's about the state itself, and that is that non-fascist hard-right or far-right parties don't tend to worship the state in quite the same way that fascist parties actually do. The rhetoric of the state embodying the interests of the entire nation and so on, so familiar to us from German and Italian fascism, is classic here. But actually that's not the case. I mean, many far-right parties now, the Austrian Freedom Party, the Tea Party in the States, insofar as it still exists, a separate existence, are neoliberal formations which want to weaken the state and reduce its power. But on the other hand, classic fascism actually seeks to impose it. It's a kind of, you might say that fascism is a kind of project of transformation, of totally transforming society and the state into something that's completely new, that will unify the people of the particular state in that kind of way. It's not necessarily with levels of violence. If you think about Italy, for example, Mussolini's regime, terrible oppressive regime and so on, but actually Mussolini killed far fewer people than Franco did in Spain. And the Francoist regime was not a fascist regime. The actual fascists in Spain were sidelined, the Falange were sidelined after Franco came to power. Gramsci in Italy was actually afforded a trial and he was released from prison to die, admittedly, towards the end of his life. In Spain, he'd been put against a wall and shot. And without any trial or anything like that. But that's the point. Italy was nevertheless a classic fascist regime, so Spain wasn't. So it's not just about the number of people who get killed. It's actually something to do with the power of the state, the transformation, the state as embodying the people, and so on. For non-fascist hard-right regimes, the project is actually more about a restoration of some previous golden age, which, if you think, is usually sometime in the 1950s or perhaps the 1930s. In Britain, it's usually about some point before mass migration began. There's this golden age of white people in Britain that we have to get back to. But you can find parallel things here. So transformation on the one hand, restoration on the other. The final thing that's a distinction between these two types of hard right regime is that fascism seeks to transcend rhetorically class. It doesn't do it in reality, of course, because it serves the interests of, in some ways, of a capitalist economy, but it rhetorically at least seeks to transcend class. Everything must be bound together in the nation as the source of all health and so on. But non-fascist far-right positions tend to actually emphasise class, in particular, and recently, an argument about the white working class as a supposedly group that's been excluded and now must be restored to its position and so on. So that's an emphasis about this. Attacks on the middle class, attacks often on millionaires and so on are supposed to be unfamiliar with what's going on in working class communities. So this attitude to class is also, I think, the final distinction. Now, other things about them, the things they might have in common, it's not actually a particular view of the economy. Hard-right regimes of any sort tend to adapt to whatever the particular dominant form of capitalist rule is at any point. So during the 1930s, Hitler, Mussolini, essentially state capitalist, a lot of state direction, state ownership, not entirely, there's still private capital in both those societies. Now it's actually divided. There's quite a few neoliberal, I mentioned the Tea Party, but the Dutch People's Party, for example, essentially neoliberal economic policy is very, very down on state ownership and control, whereas state interventionist parties would be like Jobbik in Hungary, or indeed Golden Dawn in Greece, which are very much about using the state to satisfy the kind of client groups that seek to elect them. What does unite them both is the middle class basis of these parties. And I think it's really important to emphasise this. There's a lot of stuff said about how working class people are supposed to be attracted to these parties. That was the case in UKIP, and Duncan will say a bit about that later on. It's not true. Actually, the class basis of both sorts of hard-right parties tend to be from one section of the middle class. Usually the classic petty bourgeois, sometimes the professionals. There's a kind of way of looking at class in which people who speak roughly, or who go out drinking, or who wear certain kinds of clothes and so on, are described as being working class, when in fact they're not. They're often petty bourgeois people and so on, who simply share certain kinds of cultural effects with working class people. But it's clear, in terms of what they actually do, they have to make this distinction. Final thing I want to say here is about whether fascism or indeed non-fascist hard-right parties necessarily act in the interests of capital. There is a kind of fairly fatuous argument that stems from the 1930s and Stalinism, really, that fascism is the real face of capitalism, the mask torn off monopoly capital to reveal the slavering jaws of fascism, which is always really waiting there to come to power. This is complete rubbish. Fascism only comes to power as a last resort for the bourgeoisie. It's not its natural thing that they want to rely on. It's an absolute desperate last resort in situations where they think the working class has the potential to threaten them. Often the threat is actually passed, but that's not the point. They think it is. So this is not—it's not in the interests of capital always for people. You know, Trump, no American capitalist wants a wall built between Texas and Mexico. The British ruling class, the British capital class, did not want to leave the European Union, but they're going to be forced to because of capitulations to right-wing, far-right politics by the Tory party. So that's not in the interests of capital, actually. It's important to understand that because these people are our enemies, but they're not our only enemies, and they don't necessarily do stuff. It's not necessarily always designed to actually attack the working class. Some of these are genuinely bonkers, actually, and don't, and have positions which don't fall in behind any clear class position. So that's, this is generally a kind of introduction to some of the themes and the necessary distinctions we have to make. Clearly, we're talking about hard-right parties who are not fascists. We don't confront them on the streets in the same kind of way. We try and maybe close down their meetings, we demonstrate against them and all the rest of it. We don't actually try and physically stop them meeting. If it's a fash, we do. It's absolutely important to stop them getting any kind of toehold anywhere at all. But in order to do that, you have to distinguish between the two things to know how to act. Thanks.
Thanks, Neil. In the years right after the 1916 Irish Rising, there was a military campaign, there were mass strikes, there were boycotts, there was occupations that challenged British rule in Ireland. But they didn't just challenge British rule, they really challenged the whole social order that existed in Ireland, which terrified the elites there. And I think the Russian Revolution that we're celebrating this year galvanised the Irish revolutionary struggle as well. Thousands came out in support for the revolutionary struggle in Ireland, for the revolutionary struggle in Russia, in Ireland. Striking workers in Ireland declared their occupations and strikes as Soviets, and there was a real sense that a different Ireland and a different world was very much possible. It took a vicious counter-revolution to crush those hopes for freedom and liberation. British rule ended in 26 of Ireland's 32 counties, but the outcome of the struggle was a partitioned Ireland where it was divided in two. And the two states, the two new states that were created on either side of the border, were authoritarian, they were pro-capitalist, and they were religiously very, very, very conservative. And this was a scenario that James Connolly, the great Irish socialist, had warned about. He talked about if Ireland's partitioned, it'll lead to a carnival of reaction either side of the border. And unfortunately, he was very true with that prediction. And Irish people have been living with a legacy of Ireland's defeated revolution, since the 1920s. The southern state that was created was weak economically, it was isolated, and it was dominated by the Catholic Church. The new Northern Irish state, Northern Ireland, that was created was backed by the full might of the British government and the British military, and terrified the minority Catholic population. The Orange Order was used in the north to really cement Protestant workers, the Protestant employers, and the support for the British Empire. So what I would say is today, inequality, injustice, and corruption are rampant in both states. They're rampant in either side of the border, and neither state, whether the Republic of Ireland or Northern Ireland, serves the interests of the vast majority of people that live there. The Irish state is a tax haven for global corporations. The Irish elite have basically incorporated the Republic of Ireland into the kind of global neoliberal order dominated by the US and by the EU. And you can really see that with the 2008 economic crisis, where they basically followed EU Commission orders to push through vicious austerity and have saddled now the Irish population for generations with bankers' debt. And in response to this, they faced a challenge from below, which has been fantastic to see. There's been a mass anti-water charges struggle that's brought hundreds of thousands of people onto the streets in Ireland to overthrow austerity. And that's really transformed politics. That struggle has had a big, big impact on people's consciousness and confidence. It's given workers the confidence to begin the struggle in workplaces and demand more in their contract negotiations, and there's been a wave of strikes off the back of that. Marriage equality, as people probably know, has been passed in the south of Ireland, and there's a growing movement in the Republic as well for a women's right to choose or for the right to have an abortion. There was an EU survey carried out in the last couple of years right across all the member states, where it asked people between 18 and 34 different questions. One of the questions would you join an uprising against the state in the next couple of months? And in Greece, the figure for 18 to 34 year olds was 69% of young people saying yes. I think France was in the high 60s as well. France was in the high 60s. But in Ireland, it was 54%. So that's a majority of young people saying that they would join an uprising. So that just gives you a sense of the depth of hostility to establishment politics, the austerity, and the demand for social change. So what this has meant is that establishment parties in the south are seeing their support decline, and anti-austerity parties, socialists and other radicals have made electoral breakthroughs, and they're using their elections into the Dáil as a platform to make the case, to expose how the system works, but also to make the case and encourage broader resistance. The UK EU referendum means that the Irish border has now once again become a live political issue. Partition was considered to be a parked issue, parked by the Belfast Agreement that was created in the 1990s, the Belfast Peace Agreement, following the IRA's decision to end their armed campaign against British rule. That ended up in demilitarising the border. It meant that the British Army checkpoints disappeared, and British rule in a lot of ways disappeared from the north. The Republic is part of the European Union. Northern Ireland, because it's part of the UK, is also part of the EU, and 56% of people in the north, in Northern Ireland, voted to stay in the EU. So you begin to see the Republic of Ireland remaining in the EU and the north of Ireland coming out through the Brexit vote. So this has raised the issue of the border and the possibility that a hard border or some kind of border would be reimposed again between the north and the south. Now, there's widespread opposition from all the political parties in Ireland, both sides of the border, and from the vast majority of people to any kind of physical border being reimposed. I would say people in Ireland are very much inspired by the success of Jeremy Corbyn and the support for his socialist proposals that were in his manifesto. And we want to see the Tory DUP coalition of chaos stopped in its tracks and brought down and replaced with a government for the many, not for the few, as soon as possible. And I think that it's true to say that Corbyn's success and the popularity of socialist proposals is very much raising the horizons for the Irish left, both in the north and south. But then it has to be said that politics in the north continue to be mediated through the sectarian divisions that exist there. That means its institutions and the political parties. So in the last UK election, support for nationalist and unionist blocs grew massively, and there's been a polarisation between what people refer to or call the orange versus green sectarian divide in the north. In response to the EU vote, Sinn Féin, the former political wing of the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, made the case for a border poll, where the people would be given the opportunity over the next 5 years to vote on whether or not we should get rid of the border, get rid of partition, and lay the basis for a united Ireland. And people voted for that. In response to this, the DUP, which people have been talking about a lot more, the Democratic Non-Unionist Party, appealed to Protestant voters, and we would call this beating the orange drum, to protect the union with Britain and to vote for them to stop any movement towards a united Ireland. So what this meant in the last election, that it very much squeezed the smaller, more radical parties, but definitely not entirely. People Before Profit, the party that I'm part of, we campaigned against Theresa May and the Tory vision and Brexit. We campaigned against the idea of any kind of border or any borders at all, whether they're hard or soft. We campaigned against the implementation of Tory austerity, and we made the case for a united socialist Ireland in this debate about the future of the border. And I think we got respectable votes in Derry and Foyle and West Belfast where we stood. Now, what's happened now in the north is that Northern Ireland has no government right now because the Sinn Féin DUP executive that was there, that has collapsed. So there is a sense of it collapsed because of a big financial scandal brought about by the DUP. Should be no surprises there. And there is a constant sense of political crises in the north, not just because of the referendum vote, but because of the way the peace agreement structured in crisis, because of the sectarian nature of the Assembly's politics. So there's a lot of uncertainty right now about what's going to happen. Before the Assembly had collapsed, anger was growing amongst both working-class Catholics and working-class Protestants at the DUP and Sinn Féin's power share in governments implementation of Tory austerity, cuts to public services, privatisation, plans for cutting taxes and corporations, all the same issues that made people angry in Scotland, England and Wales. That was frustrating people from both communities in the north. And also the Assembly's a failure to pass LGBT, the right for LGBT couples to have equal marriage, and also to do something about the reactionary laws governing abortion. There was a big public sector strike, a one-day strike against the DUP and Sinn Féin's austerity agreement. It was very successful. Tens of thousands of people came out to strike against it in 2015, and that was a big step forward. And it was in this context that the socialist left made a political breakthrough in getting two socialists elected to the Northern Assembly, both Eamon McCann and Jerry Carroll. Now, what we've seen in the last year and a half is that Sinn Féin really have been rewarded politically for standing up to the DUP, because Sinn Féin brought down the Assembly on the basis of the DUP failing and refusing to take responsibility for the big financial scandal that they were involved in. And as people know, the DUP is one of the most reactionary political parties in Europe, and Theresa May is now dependent on them to form a UK government. They're deeply sectarian, they're homophobic, they're sexist, they're racist, they're climate change deniers, they want creationism taught in schools, and they're linked to loyalist paramilitaries, and everything that they touch seems to turn into a financial scandal. And many people who vote for Sinn Féin are angry at inequality. They want to see marriage equality. They want to see an Irish Language Act. Many people see, rightly, that the DUP are the main impediment to bring about fundamental change in the north. But Sinn Féin, I would say, face in two directions. They call for an end to Tory austerity, but they've implemented Tory cuts. They say they want to defend public services, but they've actually backed privatisation, and they want to cut taxes on corporations. They call for equality, but they're also a pro-life party. And their vision of a united Ireland is very much one based on cutting taxes in the north in order to harmonise them with a low-tax regime in the south. And I don't think this is the kind of united Ireland that's going to attract workers or working class people in the north, never mind the south. But the big polarisation and the huge votes for Sinn Féin and the DUP over the national question will and is obscuring economic equality issues and social justice issues, even though we know it's a fact that many working class Protestants who vote for the DUP want to protect public services like the NHS, they want to see marriage equality, and they want to see abortion rights legislation changed in the north. So just to kind of summarise right now and to wrap up, I think the role of progressives, radicals, radical socialists and the revolutionary left in the north right now and across Ireland is to create an alternative based on class and social demands that can bring together working class Protestants and working class Catholics into common struggle. I mean, James Connolly made the case 100 years ago that unity between Protestants and Catholics could only be created on the basis of fighting for class demands that would lead to a struggle for a socialist Ireland, or what he called it back then, a socialist workers' republic. And I think it's absolutely true, the same is true for us today. Given the deep-rooted sectarianism in the north, this is not going to be an easy task. But we have powerful examples of Catholics and Protestants coming together in the past to fight for common demands, including the 2015 public sector strike. So the key to a fight for a society based for the many, not the few, is linking the struggle to overthrow austerity and for social justice across Ireland, north and south. What we need in Ireland is an all-Ireland heave against austerity. We need an all-Ireland struggle for the right to choose, and we need an all-Ireland struggle for ecological sustainability. So a bigger socialist left is going to be crucial to advancing those struggles. And what happens in Britain, what happens in Europe, what happens here in the United States is going to be crucial to that struggle. The struggle in Ireland is linked to the struggle to stop the Tory DUP coalition and replace it with a people's alternative based on the kind of demands that Corbyn put forward. And those are the kind of demands that will motivate and animate people as well. And the last thing I just want to say, we talked a lot about how reactionary the DUP is, but you know, it is the case that DUP supporters want many of the same things that Corbyn stood for, that people before Profit stood stood for. So as the Tory DUP continue to implement austerity in the north, we are going to be making it a priority to go into those working class Protestant areas to talk to people about a socialist alternative, a socialist Ireland as a way forward. So the way we look at it right now, we have a big opportunity to push back against austerity, and we've got everything to fight for. And I'll stop there.
J'aurais bien aimé vous parler dans cet atelier de la montée de la gauche, mais malheureusement je vais plutôt être obligée de vous parler de la montée de la droite et de l'extrême droite en France.
In this workshop, I would have loved to talk to you about the rise of the left, but instead I'm going to talk about the rise of the right in Europe.
Comme vous le savez ou pas, le Front National est arrivé au deuxième tour des élections présidentielles françaises qui ont vu s'affronter Emmanuel Macron, le candidat de la droite libérale, contre Marine Le Pen, la candidate du Front National, c'est-à-dire de l'extrême droite en France.
As you know, the National Front in France came second to the came to the second run of the elections, presidential election in France. Emmanuel Macron, the candidate of the right, against Marine Le Pen, the candidate of the extreme right.
Donc, ce n'est malheureusement pas la première fois que la France se retrouve dans une telle configuration, puisque déjà en 2002, le père de Marine Le Pen, Jean-Marie Le Pen, s'était retrouvé au deuxième tour des élections.
As a matter of fact, it's not the first time that France is in such a situation, because in 2002, the father of Marine Le Pen, Jean-Marie Le Pen, was already in the second run of the French election.
Mais par contre, il faut relever deux différences fondamentales entre 2002 et 2017.
However, there are two fundamental differences between 2002 and 2017.
La première différence, c'est le nombre de voix entre ces deux événements.
The first difference is the number of votes between the two elections.
Jean-Marie Le Pen totalisait 4 millions de voix au premier tour des élections avec une forte abstention et 5 millions de voix au deuxième tour.
Jean-Marie Le Pen in 2002 totalized about 4 million people vote for him in the first run, and a big abstention, and 5 million votes in the second run.
Sa fille aujourd'hui fait 7 millions de voix au premier tour avec une très faible abstention et 10 millions de voix au deuxième tour.
His daughter today, a few months ago, did 7 million votes with very high level of participation, and 10 million votes in the second turn.
La deuxième différence, c'est les mobilisations qui ont lieu après les résultats.
The second difference are the mobilization that happened after the election results.
En 2002, 1 million de personnes étaient descendues dans les rues pour protester contre le Front National. En 2017, personne n'est descendu dans la rue pour protester contre Marine Le Pen.
In 2002, about 1 million people descended in the street to protest against what happened during the election. But in 2017, nobody came down to the street after the election.
Alors comment expliquer ces deux phénomènes, c'est-à-dire la poussée électorale du Front National et l'absence de réaction?
So how to explain those two phenomena, the rise of the right, but the absence, and at the same time the absence of any reaction to it?
Alors cette explication doit être trouvée dans, on peut trouver trois explications en fait, qui s'articulent entre elles pour expliquer une telle évolution politique.
So there are three explanations that can be combined together to explain what is happening.
La première, c'est la droitisation de la société française. La deuxième, c'est les transformations du Front National lui-même. Et la troisième, c'est la faiblesse du mouvement ouvrier français.
The first explanation is the right-wing shift in French society. The second explanation is how the National Front reorganized itself. And the third explanation is actually the weakness of the French labor movement.
Alors, beaucoup de gens en France ont analysé la percée de l'extrême droite comme le résultat d'une stratégie du Front National qui aurait consisté à se dédiaboliser.
So many people in France try to analyze the rise of the far right as a result of a strategy of the Front National strategy that consisted of legitimizing itself.
C'est-à-dire que le Front National serait passé d'un parti considéré comme dangereux parce que fascisant à un parti populiste comme on en trouve beaucoup d'autres en Europe, par exemple en Autriche ou en Pologne.
Meaning that the National Front would transform itself from a party that was considered dangerous because a fascist party into a party that was more populistic, as you find in other countries in Europe like Austria and Poland.
Or, en réalité, c'est pas tellement que le FN s'est dédiabolisé, c'est en réalité le reste de la classe politique qui s'est considérablement droitisé.
In fact, it's not so much that the Front, National Front legitimized itself, it's more that the rest of the electoral politics legitimized it.
Pour reprendre Gramsci, on pourrait dire que dans la société française, il y a une hégémonie culturelle de la droite et de ses idées.
As Gramsci would say it, there is in the French society right now, there is a cultural hegemony of the right-wing ideas. Far-right ideas, sorry.
Alors le premier à avoir usé de cette stratégie, c'est l'ancien président de droite, Nicolas Sarkozy. Parce que quand il a été élu en 2007 pour casser le Front National, a repris à son compte les thématiques de l'immigration et de l'insécurité.
The first person to use this strategy was the former president of the Republic, Sarkozy, because when he was elected in 2007, he actually took over the rhetoric of the immigration and insecurity from the National Front.
Et par la suite, ces trois événements qui ont très largement contribué à droitiser la société française.
But after that, the three main major events that largely contributed to bring this rightward shift in French society.
Where? Le premier s'est déroulé pendant le vote de la loi qui a autorisé le mariage homosexuel en France en 2013.
The first event happened during the campaign for marriage equality in France in 2013.
On a assisté dans la société à un déferlement de propos homophobes et à des manifestations qui ont réuni jusqu'à 1 million de personnes et qui mettaient en avant les valeurs de la famille et les valeurs de la tradition.
We saw in France a wave of homophobic speeches and demonstrations that gathered about 1 million people against gay marriage and in favor of traditional family values.
Et surtout, cette séquence de la vie politique française a permis l'émergence de groupes particulièrement réactionnaires qui ont fait la jonction entre la droite et l'extrême droite et qui ont occupé la rue et le débat public pendant plusieurs mois.
This permitted the emergence of particularly staunchly reactionary groups in France that actually did the bridge between the right and the far and the traditional right, the far right and the traditional right, and they also went to the street and they also occupied the public debates.
Ensuite, la droitisation de la société s'est manifestée avec les attentats.
The other explanation for the rightward shift of society happened with the terror attacks.
On a assisté à une surenchère sur les questions de sécurité, mais aussi avec une vague de racisme et d'islamophobie qu'on avait peu connue jusqu'à ce moment-là.
We saw a wave beating of more security and also a wave of racism and Islamophobia that we have never experienced before.
Pour résumer, les musulmans étaient alors sommés de prouver qu'ils étaient de bons Français, de bons républicains par les médias et la classe politique.
To sum up, Muslims were asked to prove that they were good French people by the media and the political class.
et ce qu'on appelle la laïcité en France, c'est-à-dire un compromis politique entre l'Église et l'État visant à renvoyer la religion dans l'espace privé. La laïcité a été utilisée pour stigmatiser les musulmans et se livrer à un certain nombre d'attaques racistes de la part de la population, mais aussi de l'État.
What we call secularization in France, meaning a compromise between the church and the state in order to bring back religion to a private sphere, secularization has been used to actually stigmatize Muslims and actually help attacks against Muslims.
Je pourrais prendre ici l'exemple, par exemple, du burkini. Que j'ai déjà. Bon, le burkini, c'est une espèce de combinaison que quelques femmes, j'insiste bien, quelques femmes portent, musulmanes très pratiquantes, portent pour aller se baigner. Eh bien, ce burkini, au nom du principe de la laïcité, a été interdit de port sur certaines plages en France.
For example, there's a controversy about the burkini in France, which is an overall swimsuit for women, Muslim women that are devoted. That permit them to go bathe in public. This burkini has been forbidden on several beaches in the name of secularization.
Or, normalement, le principe de laïcité ne s'applique que dans les institutions relevant de l'État ou dans certains lieux comme les écoles, par exemple, mais en aucun cas dans l'ensemble des lieux publics.
Even though the principle of secularization would only be applied, which should only be applied in this state institution or schools, for example, but in any case, in no case, in public sphere.
Je voudrais aussi parler d'un autre exemple parce qu'il est assez marquant. C'est le président Hollande qui était donc un président en théorie socialiste.
Oh, and I want to talk about another example. It concerns President Hollande, who is supposed to be a socialist president.
Le président Hollande a repris une des propositions du Front National après les attentats, qui visait à déchoir de leur nationalité les personnes qui avaient une double nationalité et qui s'étaient rendues coupables de terrorisme.
Okay, this is going to be hard. Hollande actually took over a proposition from the National Front that was geared towards binationals, French and mostly people from Muslim countries, to actually revoke their binationality if they were implicated in terrorism.
Et c'était une façon assez insidieuse, en réalité, de pointer du doigt les étrangers, puisqu'en réalité, tous ceux qui ont commis la plupart des attaques terroristes qui ont été commis en France ont été commises par des Français.
It was a very deceptive way to point to foreigners, because in fact, all of the perpetrators of terrorist attacks were actually French.
Donc là, on voit bien, c'est un exemple, la mesure n'a pas été adoptée finalement, mais ça montre très clairement la droitisation de la vie politique française.
So the law wasn't passed, thanks God, but it shows very much how this rightward shift of the French society.
Donc dans ce contexte, Marine Le Pen a mené une politique qui, elle, était très habile.
Given this context, Marine Le Pen was very... agile, very clever in her politics.
Elle a été très agile parce qu'en réalité elle n'avait plus besoin de tenir des propos racistes sur les immigrés comme le faisait son père.
She was very smart because in fact she didn't have to give racist sorry because she didn't have to speak with racist tone as her father would do.
Elle n'avait plus qu'à se présenter comme une fervente défenseuse de la laïcité et de la laïcité républicaine en stigmatisant les musulmans.
She just have to present herself as a devoted defender of French secularization by stigmatizing Muslims.
De la même façon, elle s'est présentée sous un nouveau jour qu'on ne lui connaissait pas, c'est-à-dire sous le jour du féminisme.
By the same token, she presented herself into another light, a light that we never knew about her, as a feminist.
Mais oui, parce qu'il lui suffisait plus, il n'avait plus qu'à défendre les droits des femmes bafouées par l'islam.
Because now she just have to defend the right, the Muslim women's right that were
women
violated by Islam.
Enfin, un dernier élément de la droitisation de cette vie politique française.
Finally, the last element of the rightward shift of the French political life.
C'est la gestion de la crise des migrants. La France fait partie des pays d'Europe qui accueillent le moins de migrants.
It is the managing of the immigration crisis. In fact, France is one of the countries in Europe that accept the least number of immigrants.
Les migrants qui transitent sur le territoire français sont livrés à leur propre sort et sont régulièrement chassés par la police.
The immigrants that arrive on the French territories are actually left by their own token and regularly
chassés par la police.
Hunted by the police.
Donc à Paris ou à Calais, avec la frontière avec l'Angleterre, ce sont des milliers de migrants qui vivent sur les trottoirs et qui n'arrivent à survivre qu'avec le soutien des associations et des habitants.
So in Paris or Calais, which is very close to Great Britain, there are thousands of immigrants that live homeless and only survive with the help of NGOs and the locals.
Et les réactions de la population sont parfois très hostiles, avec des manifestations de rejet qui peuvent aussi aller jusqu'à des violences.
And the reaction of the population are sometimes very hostile, with a lot of rejection that also sometimes goes up to violence.
Alors dans cette situation de droitisation de la société, le Front National est donc devenu un parti qui est beaucoup moins isolé et qui est devenu beaucoup plus fréquentable.
So with this context, the National Front became a party that was much less isolated and more frequentable.
Surtout au fur et à mesure que toutes les idées racistes et sécuritaires du Front National se sont diffusées dans tout le champ politique, le Front National a pu adopter un autre profil, c'est-à-dire un profil beaucoup plus social.
Because all those right-wing ideas actually diffused broadly among all the sectors of the French politics, the National Front could concentrate on another aspect of its politics, and they became the social aspect.
Le Front National du temps du père, hein, du temps de Jean-Marie Le Pen, était un parti qui était plutôt libéral et qui était plutôt tourné vers les petits commerçants.
The National Front in the time of her father, Jean-Marie, was a party that was mostly geared towards neoliberalism and looking towards the interests of petite bourgeoisie.
Sa fille a complètement changé de stratégie.
His daughter has completely changed strategy.
Elle s'est fait le fer de lance de la protection sociale des Français et contre la mondialisation et contre les politiques austéritaires de l'Union européenne.
She spearheaded the protection of the interests of the French ordinary French people against globalization and against the authoritarian politics, austerity politics of European Union.
Alors bien sûr, quand on y regarde de plus près, on voit que les solutions qui sont proposées, les solutions pour remédier au problème, elles n'ont pas changé.
But of course, if you look at it more closely, you can see that the solutions to remedy the problem haven't exactly changed.
Ces solutions consistent surtout dans le maintien d'une économie capitaliste et des profits.
The solutions lies in maintaining the capitalist economy and the profit system.
Mais à l'intérieur des frontières nationales.
But within national borders.
Et surtout, elle persiste à proposer la mise en place de politiques discriminatoires envers les immigrés.
And most of all, they continue to insist on discriminating against immigrants.
Mais malheureusement, son discours de dénonciation du système fonctionne.
Unfortunately, Marine Le Pen's discourse on denouncing the system is still works well.
Et il fonctionne notamment dans la classe ouvrière et dans la jeunesse où elle fait de très bons scores.
And it works in the working class and in the youth where it's actually well welcome.
Alors pour relativiser cela dit, c'est surtout l'abstention qui est la plus forte chez les ouvriers et chez les jeunes.
But to relativize, in fact, it's abstention that is the most strong among the workers and the youth.
Et en réalité, elle réalise ses meilleurs scores, surtout parmi les petites classes moyennes qui sont en voie de déclassement ou qui se sentent déclassées, comme aux États-Unis, je pense, avec Trump.
And Marine Le Pen actually succeeds very well among small, lower middle class who are, you know, shifting backward, downwards to lower classes.
Alors, le succès de ce tournant social du FN laisse à penser certains que le Front National aurait donc changé de nature.
So the success of the National Front makes people think that the National Front actually changed, is not the same anymore.
Qu'il serait passé d'un parti fascisant à un parti populiste.
That from a fascist party it became a populist party.
Alors, c'est en partie vrai si on pense que le populisme est fondé sur un discours qui met en avant l'opposition entre le peuple et les élites.
It seems true if you think that populism is founded on a discourse that put forward the opposition between the people and the elites.
C'est en partie vrai si on pense aussi que le populisme repose sur une critique de la mondialisation et sur
It rings true if you think that populism lie on a critique of the globalization, criticizing the globalization.
Et si le populisme prône un système protectionniste et une politique anti-migratoire ferme.
And if protectionism relies on the politic anti-migratory politics firm and protectionist.
Donc oui, on peut dire que le Front National a changé de nature pour devenir un parti populiste.
So in this case, you can say yes, the National Front changed nature to become a populist party.
Mais pour inverser à l'inverse, en réalité, contrairement aussi à d'autres partis populistes, la structure dirigeante du Front National reste bien constituée par de vrais fascistes qui ont, eux, un vrai projet fasciste.
But unlike other populist parties, the structure of the National Front stays fascist and with real true fascist projects.
Et si jamais le Front National était en mesure de prendre le pouvoir, malheureusement, les institutions de la République française lui permettraient assez aisément de mettre en place un système autoritaire.
In the unfortunate case that the National Front were able to take power, the institution of the French Republic would actually enable them easily to put in place a system very authoritarian.
Juste pour rappeler, les institutions de la Ve République ont été mises en place par le général de Gaulle, donc par un militaire dans le contexte d'une guerre d'indépendance coloniale, et donc tout prévoit en réalité des mesures d'exception qui peuvent être mises en place très rapidement.
As a historical parenthesis, the institution of the Fifth Republic was put in place by General de Gaulle, which was a military, so with a lot of provisions concerning, you know, the use of military to actually control the people.
Alors maintenant, il faut aborder la question de la faiblesse du mouvement ouvrier par rapport à la montée de l'extrême droite en France.
So now we're going to talk about the weakness of the labor movement in France vis-à-vis the rise of the National Front.
Alors, le Front National, avec son nouveau profil social qui s'est donné, pose plusieurs problèmes au mouvement ouvrier aujourd'hui.
So the National Front, with this new social agenda, gives several problems to the labor movement today.
Premièrement, le Front National occupe un espace que nous peinons à occuper.
peut dire.
Yeah. Firstly, the National Front occupy a space that we, the far left, have hard time occupying ourselves.
C'est-à-dire que, en réalité, la crise nourrit plus le Front National que le mouvement ouvrier.
In fact, the National Front benefits more from the crisis than the labor movement.
Deuxièmement, le Front National n'arrive plus à mobiliser sur les dangers que représente le Front National. Non, pardon, le mouvement ouvrier n'arrive plus à mobiliser sur les dangers que représente le Front National.
Secondly, the labor movement is not able anymore to mobilize against the danger posed by the National Front.
Alors, je vais parler d'abord du problème de l'espace politique qui est occupé par le Front National.
So I'm going to first talk about the political space that is occupied by the National Front.
Je n'ai malheureusement pas le temps de revenir ici parce que ça serait trop long de revenir sur les raisons de l'affaiblissement du mouvement ouvrier français.
It would be a too long discourse, but I don't have time to come back on the reasons for the weakness of the labor movement in France.
Mais sachez que le mouvement ouvrier est affaibli et qu'il est divisé.
But let it be known that the French labor movement is weakened and divided.
Et surtout, il peine à proposer des alternatives qui paraissent accessibles et concrètes à la population.
And it is difficult for the labor movement to propose alternatives that seems concrete and realistic to the population.
Contrairement au Front National, nous proposons à notre classe de prendre nos affaires en main et de nous représenter nous-mêmes.
Contrary to the National Front, we, the far left, proposed that the labor movement should take its own its own business in hand and to represent itself.
Alors que l'extrême droite, elle, propose de prendre les choses en main en notre place et de décider pour nous.
But the far right, on the other hand, is talking about taking over the business of the working class and to decide for us.
Et dans une société qui est très divisée,
so in a very divided society,
dans une société où s'en prendre aux plus faibles paraît toujours plus simple que de s'en prendre aux plus forts,
in a society where kicking the weakest is always easier than kicking the strongest,
dans une société où les collectifs de travail et dans les quartiers tendent à disparaître,
in a society where workers groups and district groups tends to disappear,
les solutions proposées par le Front National paraissent beaucoup plus accessibles.
The solution proposed by the National Front seems to be more accessible.
Ensuite, pour répondre à la question, pour savoir pourquoi est-ce qu'on n'arrive plus à mobiliser contre les dangers de l'extrême droite.
And now if you want to answer the question why aren't we able to mobilize against the danger of the far right?
C'est aussi en partie parce que le mouvement ouvrier est très divisé sur la question.
It is also in part because the labor movement in France is very divided on this question.
Il existe des divisions sur l'analyse de la nature du Front National.
There are divisions on the analysis of the nature of the National Front.
Sa nature fasciste, mais aussi sur les rapports qu'entretient la bourgeoisie avec lui.
Its fascist nature, but also questions about the relationship between the bourgeoisie and the National Front.
Pour certains mouvements, dans une doxa un peu trotskiste.
For certain, in a Trotskist analysis.
Le Front National ne représenterait pas un danger parce que la bourgeoisie n'a pas besoin de lui.
The National Front wouldn't be a danger because the bourgeoisie doesn't need it.
Alors c'est vrai, la bourgeoisie n'a pas besoin du Front National car elle n'est pas en danger, elle n'est pas remise en cause.
So that's true, the bourgeoisie doesn't need the National Front because she's not, it's not in danger right now.
Mais il n'empêche que si le Front National accédait au pouvoir, les dégâts seraient considérables, en particulier pour les immigrés et pour tous les gens qui sont issus de l'immigration.
Nevertheless, if the National Front were to succeed in achieving power, the damage would be considerable, in particular for the immigrants and
les gens issus de l'immigration.
And the people coming from and other immigrants.
Il existe aussi beaucoup de divisions sur la question de l'islamophobie.
There exist also many divisions on the question of Islamophobia.
Pour une partie du mouvement ouvrier, il faut lutter contre le racisme, mais non défendre l'islam.
For a part of the labor movement, we need to fight against
racism.
Against racism, but we should not defend Islam.
Il ne faut pas défendre l'islam, qui est, comme toutes les religions, considéré comme une forme d'oppression.
We should not defend Islam because, as any kind of religion, it is considered as a form of oppression.
Donc, pour toutes ces raisons, il reste très difficile de mobiliser largement contre le Front National et le racisme.
For all these reasons, it's very difficult to mobilize to mobilize against the National Front and racism.
Donc, les tâches du mouvement ouvrier à l'heure actuelle.
So the task of the labor movement right now.
C'est d'abord à long terme de reconstruire un mouvement ouvrier qui soit en capacité de porter un projet mobilisateur, émancipateur et internationaliste.
So it's the first task is a long-term project where the labor movement should be able to offer a project of that can mobilize and emancipate. And it's also internationalist in nature.
Et en attendant cette reconstruction, la tâche principale reste de construire des mobilisations et des solidarités.
Waiting for this reconstruction, the principal task is to mobilize. It's to create mobilization and solidarities.
Pour montrer que la fermeture des frontières et les politiques racistes ne protègent pas du capitalisme et de sa logique destructrice.
To show that closing the borders and the racist politics will not protect from the capitalism and its destructive logic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi there. Can you hear me? Is this okay? No? Like this?
Yes.
All right. Now, I think that for those of you that know the Netherlands, you might have noticed that in the past couple of years, our public image has changed tremendously from being like this tolerant country that prides itself on its tolerance towards marijuana, same-sex marriage, all that kind of stuff. Now we are, I think, mostly familiar or mostly known for our racism and for the our right-wing politicians. And what happened in the past 15 years is really that racism has been much and much more normalized in the Netherlands, and especially Islamophobia has. The main figure in this has been Geert Wilders of the People's Party, who you know, is not a fascist, but who is a racist, who has been using more and more violent racist rhetoric, and it was being helped by the right wing and extreme right media to, you know, have his ideas spread over the country. This racism has gone mostly unchecked in the past decades, and part of it is because center parties have been eager to utilize racism in order to justify their support for the wars in the Middle East, for the occupations, but also to divert attention from neoliberal restructuring and from austerity politics. The left, and especially the Socialist Party, which is the most left-wing party in our country has not spoken out against racism and has even refused to join anti-racist demonstrations against Wilders, because it's their colleague, after all. And I think, especially after the big struggles of 2002 to 2006, when the anti-war movement receded and the sort of the anti-racist sentiment that was a part of the anti-war movement also sort of disappeared, then especially racism really struck deep roots. At the same time, if you compare the Netherlands to Germany, we don't see the same amount of organized fascist groups and organized fascist attacks. There's been some instances of this, but we don't have a real fascist movement on the streets at this moment. What we do have is racism that is, you know, become almost common sense to an extent. Like, you have the concept of how do you call it, of Islamization, right? You're familiar with it. It basically means that Muslims have this secret agenda to take over the world, right? It's and if you trace this idea, it's basically an adaptation of the concept of Jewification that gained currency in the late 19th century in Germany. Now, what happened in the last elections is that, contrary to public belief or popular belief, is that the extreme right and the far right has strengthened itself. Wilders did not become the biggest party, but he still won 5 extra seats. And even more importantly, second party to his right has emerged, called the Forum for Democracy, which is actually a fascist group. I'll come back to that. Now, what happened in this election is that the Social Democrats were virtually wiped out for their support of a very right-wing government. And you would think that the Socialist Party would profit from this, but they even in this situation managed to lose one seat. And I think there's two reasons for this. One is that their social program did not manage to inspire. They had some very good proposals concerning healthcare and a bunch of other good proposals, but they didn't want to fight for it. They organized some street protests, but they were meant to gain votes, not to build the struggle and to build pressure and to, you know, really force through the issue. That's one thing. Second thing is that they have not spoken out against racism, and they did not have an answer to the extreme right. This is mainly because of their sort of economism, right? They really believe that if we get universal healthcare and we get all these bunch of nice things, then racism will disappear. Which means that they are not anti-racist, and they are even afraid to be anti-racist because that might divide the working class. To give you an example of this, on the day of the Women's March, the day after the inauguration, we had also, no, I know what you were doing, we were also protesting that these days. What happened was Lilia Marijnis, who is likely to be the new leader of the Socialist Party, she went on the radio to talk about Trump, and she said she found him very refreshing because he was talking the language of the people. Yeah. She was talking the language of the people, so she found it refreshing, and she pointed out that she agreed with him on his opposition to TTIP and his emphasis on investment. Thus, the right was made, well, this is, you can see how with such a left, the radical right can can build its movement. Now, I think the emergence of Forum for Democracy is very important. This is a small party that gained two seats that have really tried to mimic the alt-right in the United States. And I think this is really a crypto-fascist party, though very thinly veiled. But at the same time, they are not at this moment interested in building a fascist street movement. They're interested in, portraying themselves as respectable Democrats. The reason for this is, I think, that they understand first that the left is not a threat at this moment for the Dutch ruling class, and that consequently the ruling class is not in any way interested in a fascist, you know, takeover or anything. So what they are trying to do at this this point is trying to build their movement, build their meetings, become more normalized, or how do you call it, more acceptable. And they know that, like, the extreme right media will push people in their direction. But on the other hand, they are building a movement on the basis of these crypto-fascist ideas. So what we're seeing in their ranks is something of a fascist dynamic starting to emerge. We call it a sort of DIY fascism. Like, you have small groups of people who start doing what is in the logic of the ideas of this movement. So what we're seeing, even within weeks of the elections, is that they've started organized threat campaigns against especially women who speak out and who write articles against them. So a comrade of ours, who's very young, she wrote an article about him, and they found out where she worked, who her family members were, who she knew, and they started threatening her, managed to kick her out of her job, and started to threaten everybody around her. She had to go underground for a couple of weeks, and it's just one example of what's happening. So, what do you do with a fascist group like this that doesn't portray itself as fascist when a whole lot of people don't see it as a fascist group at this point? I think most important thing to do is to expose them, not to organize any physical confrontation, but to confront them anyway. And to try to expose them. I think we can learn a whole lot about how comrades in Germany have been working on this point. What they've been doing is every time the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland, the far-right group there, every time they go to the streets or organize a meeting, they are there with a counter-protest, and this has led to a big demonstration in Cologne that drew 20,000 people at their sort of national convention or something, which meant that the contradictions within the formation were strengthened, were sort of sharpened. People saw it more as a fascist group, and actually there was a very broad sentiment against them. So cab drivers wouldn't take delegates in the city. Bars, about 150 bars, had these things, where you put your beer on, that said, "We will not give any beer to racist, fascist, and other scum." And I think, this has made clear what kind of party it is, and also it has built a movement that can go further when it's necessary. But I think at the same time, we also need to address the issue more fundamentally, and we really need to rebuild a left that is has anti-racism and it's at its core, and really wants to build the class struggle. And I think the situation in which we got to do this is difficult, of course, and potentially dangerous in the next couple of months. But at the same time, what we're seeing is a sort of an undercurrent emerging of people willing to fight racism, fight sexism, and all these kinds of things. So in March, we had the second Women's March in Amsterdam, which drew 20,000 people, which was the biggest feminist demonstration since the 1970s or something. And we've had a lot of these bigger demonstrations in the past, well, actually since the inauguration of Trump, and a lot of people, you know, figured, shit, this can actually happen. I'm not at all pessimistic on the prospects of building a new left, but at the same time, you know, the situation in which we have to do it is far from ideal.
I'm sure you all know that not much has been going on in Britain recently. So in the few minutes that I have, I kind of hope I don't sort of run out of stuff to say. The election that took place last month, as I'm sure you know, was pretty remarkable and represents a significant and largely unexpected social and political shift to the left. In spite of the huge Tory lead at the outset of the campaign, two terrorist attacks, active sabotage by a number of Labour Party MPs, and vicious attacks from much of the print media. However, those gains that have been made are still extremely fragile for a number of reasons that I'll try to touch on. I guess the first thing to say, in contrast to some of the other countries that we've heard about, Britain's rigid and quite undemocratic electoral and party system means that the general crisis of political representation that's been going on assumes a particular form in the UK. So while many other European countries have seen a serious decline in support for traditionally dominant parties and new or previously marginal formations coming to the fore from both the left and the right, in the UK this is not a realistic possibility. And so what this means is that those same kind of social dynamics tend to play out within existing party structures if and when they kind of surpass a certain scale and are consequently mediated by those structures. So of course the intention of this system is to guarantee the stability and reproduction of the status quo, but the recent period culminating in the general election actually suggests another kind of counterintuitive possibility, that this kind of forced internalization of contradictions within existing party structures might become so severe that the political field actually becomes less stable and predictable as a result. And so one illustration of that is that while, as I said, established parties across Europe are hemorrhaging support, Labour and the Conservative Party just won a combined 82.5% of the vote, which is the highest since 1970. And yet, at least as far back as I can remember, neither party has been so internally unstable or divided. So this means different things for the left and the right. For the right, a predicted landslide for the Tory party was supposed to basically secure the hegemony of a revitalized xenophobic national conservatism, both over society as a whole and, crucially, actually within the Tory party itself. So the key markers of this presumed shift are a highly confrontational approach to Brexit, an open and extremely hostile attitude towards migrants and refugees, an authoritarian mode of leadership, and a rhetorical embrace of the white working class, alongside a continuing attack on living standards. So even if they had managed to pull this off and gain a landslide, it wouldn't have been straightforward or unproblematic. British capital, as Neil said, no more wanted Brexit and the kind of politics that it has until now, at least implied, than American capital wanted Trump. But nonetheless, it would have meant that the anti-establishment element of the Brexit vote was kind of re-articulated by the traditional trusted party of the British establishment. And while not exactly desiring this outcome, I think capital could live with it as long as it provided a certain level of stability and predictability, which it hasn't, so that's great. So for the time being, that kind of sharp pivot to the right that we were expecting has been halted and maybe to some degree reversed. It's hard to kind of overstate the disaster that the Tories brought upon themselves. As you know, they lost their parliamentary majority, and Theresa May's personal authority, I think, is fatally damaged. In the words of one comedian, she looks like a cat that knows it's waiting to die. The only reason that she hasn't been put out of her misery is because nobody else wants her job. Whatever they do to kind of shore up their position in one direction leads to being undermined in another. So whether that's like the completely contradictory signals that we're now seeing coming out of different government ministries over Brexit and austerity economics, or the deal with the DUP that Sean was talking about, who, as he said, are kind of basically the political wing of the Old Testament. Not only are people kind of rightly repulsed by that deal, but it actually kind of threatens the constitutional integrity of the UK in some quite serious ways. So the fact that all of these injuries were completely self-inflicted is not only hilarious, but means that there's a real fury against the Conservative leadership, both from other factions within the party and from significant sections of the media and business who are now kind of speaking through the Treasury. So in other words, the political system and ultimately the state itself is struggling to do what it normally does, which is to organise the ruling class. And so their disunity potentially means opportunities for the left. Just a note of caution, though, that while this kind of rightward shift at the level of the state has been somewhat rolled back, a possible consequence of the unravelling of that project is a renewal of far-right and fascist street politics under the kind of dog whistle racism of opposing extremism. So there have been fairly large mobilisations recently in Manchester, Liverpool and London, some of which were successfully opposed and some of which weren't. And so that crisis of the mainstream right might lead to a revival of the extreme right. At the same time, we can't forget that the Tories did actually secure their largest number of votes since 1983, and the social tendencies which drove that haven't gone away and continue to form one side of a widening social polarisation. As far as the left goes, the Labour Party is actually also in crisis, and from a certain perspective, an existential one. But it has something with the Conservatives' lack, which is a dynamic and, for the time being, ascendant faction, namely Corbynism. So, you heard about, I don't know, do you know who he is? we don't have time to talk through like all of the internal Labour Party battles, but it does appear that the kind of the struggle within the party to take over key parts of it may actually finally be starting to gather some serious momentum. A number of constituency Labour Party branches have fallen under Corbynite control since the election. A large number of left delegates and motions, I believe, put forward to the Labour Party conference in autumn, which is kind of the key site of the struggle between the left and right there. So we can talk through a bit of what that means in the kind of discussion section, but in the few minutes that I have left, I want to say a little about Corbynism as a social phenomenon. So essentially, I think what we're seeing is the expression of an emerging class subject that's beginning to recognise itself as such and enter onto the political stage as an agent, not a revolutionary agent and not necessarily a very particularly strong or organised one, but still an agent nonetheless. So that's something that is already a big step forward. This is not the same class that existed in the 1970s, but a section that has undergone a long process of recomposition, for which the marker of age coincidentally happens to serve as like a rough correlative proxy. In other words, the youthfulness of much of Corbyn's support is not a sign of kind of starry-eyed naivety, as much of the mainstream media would have us believe, but like a coincidental attribute of much of the contemporary working class in an advanced capitalist economy, in which previously middle-class jobs are proletarianized, education level ceases to be a reliable predictor of income, and access to wealth through home ownership becomes unimaginable for millions. And as we know, all of these things affect the young disproportionately. And that this constituency is so often misread by mainstream pundits as a kind of like privileged middle class elite liberal urban intelligentsia is a reflection of the cultural framework through which they continue to view class, the flip side of which is the white working class standing in for class as a whole, and as Neil said, they're often not actually working class at all. So In addition to this, like re-proletarianized precariat, as it's sometimes called, Corbynism also gathered 20 to 25% of previous UKIP voters, demonstrating that at least a significant portion of those people can be won to left politics, despite them having a completely opposed position on Brexit to the previous group that I described overall. In addition to that, he did reach into some of the most oppressed and marginalised disproportionately non-white sections of the working class, and if the cultural signifier of this was the grime for Corbyn phenomenon, the idea of that, I guess, was like to get people into Corbyn through grime, but I'm so uncool that I actually got into grime through Corbyn. But, if that's the kind of cultural signifier of that, the main political expression occurred in the aftermath of the Grenfell fire, when local residents, after storming the local council building, chanted both for justice and for the fall of the government. And more generally, that incident of social, political and corporate murder has added an element of sharp class rage to a pre-existing atmosphere of mass activity and hope that can build up through the election. I'm going to just maybe skip to the end so we have time for discussion. But just to say that the fact that this is still a new and fragile formation means that it's kind of hard to know strategically how to relate to those this layer of people. But I think more fruitful than fixating on whether or not you as an organisation should join the Labour Party, it's more important to actually develop collective understandings of Corbynism and figure out whether it's in your workplace, union, community struggle, wherever it might be, how to actually meet those people where they are and try to kind of push the logic of that movement into more radical or revolutionary positions. So, thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.